Welcome to episode 33 of Newey Tech People. On this episode, I speak with Siobhan Curran from I2M. We discuss everything innovation in the Newcastle tech ecosystem. Siobhan's as close to the innovation ecosystem as anyone within the community, and it's interesting to hear her insights on where we've come from and the journey ahead. Hope you enjoy this episode. Episode 33 of Newey Tech People. Today we have Siobhan Curran from Manager I2N. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
For those that don't know you, give us a quick overview of who are you and what's your current role?
Okay, so I work at the University of Newcastle. The area I work in is in the Research and Innovation Division. So we have research and people doing amazing stuff in that space. And then we also have another area of that division, which is focused on innovation. So that's how do we take research discoveries and provide real world impact. And one of the ways we can do that is by spinning out the intellectual property that's generated from those research discoveries and creating startups or spin outs. And the other area that we can also help with is with students and alumni, as well as the wider community. So we're not focused specifically on people who only have an affiliation with the university. Anyone can participate within our programs to help them realise any ideas that they might have around a business. So validation of the business idea, generating problem solution fits. I've seen a problem and I think I've got an idea that might help it. Does it actually work? And then if they can figure that out, that it does, then is there product market fit? So are there enough customers out there that would actually justify a business model that's going to generate me enough money so that I can make a living out of it and then grow the company? Yeah. All the way through to scale-ups. So we service all of those, what we call the innovators, the research teams, and then the entrepreneurs, everybody else, to help build up their enterprise skill development, start up their companies and help them to go scale. So we do that through three innovation hubs, and we have one at Hunter Street and then another one up at Muswellbrook and one at Williamtown.
Yeah.
Soon to have a fourth one come online in early 2021 at Honeysuckle.
Wow.
So we have the infrastructure, the spaces, the co-working spaces and teaching spaces, and then also the programs to help all of those people realise their dreams.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I manage the small team that runs those hubs.
And how long has I2M been about?
So we kicked off in 2016, at the end of 2016, when we opened up the Hunter Street hub.
Yeah.
So the idea was that we would build this interim hub that where we could test all the assumptions we had around how the hub was going to operate. So the hub proper, the new one that we planned to build at Honeysuckle. Let's do a little MVP, a little minimum viable product, like a startup, and test all the assumptions we had about what we thought the market needed and wanted, what services were required. And we've learned a lot being able to do that. And it's really helped inform the design and the programs that we need to get up online and running when the new hub opens in 2021.
Perfect.
And the other interesting thing is that the innovation hubs actually work very differently from each other. So the initial assumption was that, well, we test and validate programming at Hunter Street and then we just like cookie cutter that into Williamtown and Muswellbrook. But even within a regional ecosystem like the Hunter, each area of the region works very differently and has completely different needs, density, connectivity within the ecosystem. And so each of those hubs actually works differently to each other as well. So we deliver some entrepreneurship programming at Williamtown and co-working space for entrepreneurs who are more affiliated with defence and aerospace, given the proximity to the RAF base and the defence primes up there. And then, but we also have a lot of government and industry partners who kind of use it as like the Switzerland. So you don't have to go on base. But if you don't want to have meetings at one of the primes, you can have them at our hub instead and everyone can kind of come to this neutral territory to be able to have their meetings and their planning days and that kind of thing with government or representatives from the University of Newcastle if they're doing research partnerships. And then the hub up at Muswellbrook, we deliver a series of programs up there called Business Bootcamp. So there aren't a whole bunch of entrepreneurs that are knocking on our door to commence startups in Muswellbrook. It's a pretty small town. And why would you start a startup and take all the risk that's associated with that if you can drive a truck in the mines for 100K a year?
Yeah.
So what we do up there is what we call business boot camps, and they're a series of workshops. And we work with SMEs who are kind of relying predominantly on the mines and the employees of the mines to have a business.
Yeah.
So it might be a welding company, for example.
Yeah.
Their main client is the mines. So we get them to look at their business model and understand whether or not there might be opportunities for them to expand into other markets, so that should a mining downturn happen, that they've got opportunities available to them, sort of,
yeah, that's great,
up their sleeve that they can explore.
Nice. And then obviously the one in Hunter Street, different again.
Well, it's purely entrepreneurship for high growth potential startups.
That's
so
right.
We do have a couple of scale ups in there as well.
Yeah.
So companies that we have one company called CloudSense. So they're an international SaaS company that develops plugins for Salesforce.
Yeah.
And their R&D team, so their headquarters are in Croatia.
Yeah.
They have offices in London, the US, Sydney and Melbourne, but they've decided to open up their R&D for APAC in Newcastle because they want to be able to take advantage of the talent coming out of the University of Newcastle. So they've been able to employ, take on work integrated learning students and then also employ graduates as well as part of that kind of, it's a good process to be able to do work integrated learning. It's almost like a little internship, a little interview process, see who the really skilled students are and then offer them a position when they're
finished. It's a perfect test market. I think, you know, outside of that, what I've seen in the tech market as well, the companies that do take on those graduates or that work integrated learning, and then you've got a perfect opportunity to test them out, see what they're like, see who best integrates with your team. And hey, if that's not your best and most sensible hire, I don't know what is.
Right. You can only tell so much over an interview or
correct.
Looking at a CV,
yep.
actually seeing them work and doing the code or whatever it is.
Yep.
Yeah,
it's perfect. And hopefully we do see more of that. It's more bigger or international companies having either little hubs or bases here and take advantage of that. I know a lot of companies are, you know, have that conversation on how do we partner with the university and get that graduate program. I think everyone wants, hey, I'll take all the best developers from Newcastle University, but I don't think it perfectly works that way. It's good for the graduates to have options.
Oh, totally. So our newish Vice Chancellor, Alex Zielinski, he's quite keen on seeing all students undertake work integrated learning, no matter what degree they're doing. And so that provides a huge opportunity for businesses locally to be able to engage with the university that way.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah.
That's perfect. And I2N is obviously a big part of that sort of innovation ecosystem we're trying to build here. I think we try to do our little part with the podcast here and more in the tech community, but tech community is obviously a part of that innovation ecosystem and the startup scene as well. So I think it's good just to see more players and somebody as big as the university investing so much in that ecosystem, right?
Yeah, I mean, we've got a huge talent pool, which are our students and our alumni, and you know, a vast majority of the students live within the Hunter region who attend the university. They're often first in family. They've come through enabling programs. They've got a real commitment to, you know, an affiliation with the University of Newcastle. And, you know, it's our job to not only, you know, equip them with the domain expertise that they get through studying their degree, but also providing them with opportunities to be able to develop those enterprise skills and those soft skills that are obviously useful if you want to start up your own company, but also within, you know, a knowledge base business.
Yeah,
you know, you need to understand how business works and what value you as an employee can add to that company by coming up with new ideas and new concepts and working in teams on problems that you don't have all the answers for in really short time frames and being able to deliver it confidently as an option to your boss. You know, that is what employees love, right?
Oh, yeah.
So if we can help, the I2N can help develop out those enterprise skills for both what we call intrapreneurs, people within companies, and also entrepreneurs, people who are starting their own companies, that's exactly what we're setting out to do.
Yeah, there's a big opportunity there.
Mm.
And you mentioned before the growth, like obviously the growth with the big hub on Honeysuckle Drive.
Mm.
What sort of time frame do we have there? How big are we looking at for that?
So
hub?
Hunter Street Hub, we've got 32 desks.
Yeah.
So we've got about 3 desks free at the moment. The new hub will have about 120 desks.
Wow.
So it's combined with the School of Creative Industries. So we've got 4 floors. And the way we've kind of designed the building is following the journey of an innovator or an entrepreneur. So the ground floor is very much open to the community. It's very much the what we call the first stage, which is all about exploration. So I've got an idea, but I don't really know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So we have an innovation concierge desk. So if you've got any questions about how you engage with the university, how do you engage with the programs, where do I need to go to get help, that's where you go. There's desk space for people who are either working on our first stage programming, which we call Entrepreneurship 101, students that might be studying Bachelor of Innovation in Entrepreneurship or doing a double major, students, researchers that might be participating within on Prime. They can work from that ground floor at no cost. That's where we'll probably end up delivering a lot of our venture mentor service, mentoring meetings as well with entrepreneurs. There'll be a makerspace, so prototype development can happen, and a big event space as well. And we've got end-of-ride facilities because we're relying very much on, you know, active transportation to get in and out of the city along with the light rail line. And then the next level up is School of Creative Industries. So they've got an animation lab and a black box studio in that space, which hopefully our startups will be able to utilize too for stuff like developing their own marketing, like podcasts and green screen for their own, you know, marketing, digital marketing that they want to generate. And then the next floor up is teaching and learning space. So it's for us to be able to deliver our pre-accelerator and accelerator programming, so much more cohort-based programming, because we find that new businesses will survive longer if they have a team, a founding team, as opposed to a solo entrepreneur. And solo entrepreneurs can obviously work really well as sole proprietors, and they can work well in tech companies as well, but the research definitely suggests that they work much better and survive longer if they have a good solid interdisciplinary team working on the founding team. And then we have the top floor, which is the innovation hub proper. So that's where all of the co-working space, office space, meeting rooms, boardroom, big kitchen and sort of open plan meeting spaces will be contained. And so that will sort of be more for the accelerator teams, people participating within the accelerator program, as well as people who are then incubating after they've been through the accelerator program as well. So as long as they keep achieving their milestones that they're setting for the company, they can continue staying there until they get too big for the space and hopefully move somewhere locally around the corner or somewhere else within the city, so that we can kind of keep that innovation ecosystem growing and developing.
Oh, it makes sense as well. Hey, if you've had success going through that and there's more talent coming in, you'd be mad not to,
try to take advantage and there's this really good sort of culture of what they call entrepreneurship recycling. So even if you're not successful going through the pre-accelerator program, like you don't have product market fit, and that's good, right? Because you figure that out really early without spending a whole lot of money developing out
any time, effort,
the prototype or whatever, or the full-on product, and then launch it and then find no one likes it. So if you can figure that out, you're a really valuable mentor for people who are really at the beginning at E101 stage, you know, and being able to provide your expertise on the things that went wrong so that you can help. And we have a really good culture of that in Newcastle. And I think entrepreneurship ecosystems generally have a really good culture of people just wanting to give back and help, you know, the new people coming through so that they don't make the same mistakes. Yeah.
They're potentially also really good employees for other people. Like, not everybody's a number one, right? Not everybody's a founder. Somebody could be a great founding member but a part of a team, or somebody's a great number seven employee at a company.
Absolutely.
And, hey, they might have gone through that, realised, hey, this is not for me. I tried it. It was a stressful experience. I've a bunch of time, effort. I still like that innovation. I still like a startup type feel or a high growth company type feel. Maybe I can join a company who's a couple of years in, who has got a bit of traction, and they're the perfect employees for that type of thing.
You know, and even like working in that kind of an environment at really that early stage is completely different to going and working for an established company like NIB.
Phenomenally different.
You're still wearing a lot of different hats as this employee number seven, as you would be almost working with a founder. In fact, we've actually got a program we're developing for our students before they go to do work integrated learning with a startup, where they come and listen to some tech founders talk about what it's like as a founder of a company in those first few years and all of the challenges that they've got ahead, all the competing demands that they've got, and what their expectations are of students coming in as work integrated learning students, that you're not going to get shadowed, you're not going to get your own desk and, like, you know, have the project there and someone constantly holding your hand. You've got to show these soft skills and this initiative to be able to, you know, solve a problem without knowing all the facts and feel like you're confident enough that you can deliver it as an option to the boss, right? And It's like the perfect environment for work integrated learning, because you're seeing firsthand all the different pressures and all of the different all the balls that the founder's having to juggle in one like they're sitting opposite you, right?
There's so all the real challenges, right?
And you could be writing the first line of code for the, you know, the code for the product that makes the minimum viable product or the prototype get out into the market.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes that code's still sitting there like years later, and you as a work integrated learning student could have been the one that helped build that code. So it's pretty cool experience.
Yeah, really good opportunities. Mm. Oh, that'd be phenomenal once that's up and running. And as you said, it's good to have had the MVP out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, testing that, what works, what doesn't. So when it goes that the full suite, you're a long way down the track in, you know, knowing exactly what will and won't work.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we sort of see that having a pipeline of people to be able to feed into the Innovation Hub and fill those desks has been really critical. So, you know, it's easy to think that you could just do, you know, like a tack on a couple of innovation courses within an existing degree and think that that's going to provide your pipeline. But, you know, we've got a lot of people already innovating, or people who have ideas, or they've come from BHP and they're tinkering in their backyards and they've got some really amazing knowledge and domain expertise. They just don't have the opportunity yet to express it. And the I2N really does give them the opportunity to be able to play around with the concepts and the ideas that they've got.
Completely agree. There's a lot of extremely smart people in our big corporates around Newcastle.
Absolutely.
Who have ideas, who have plenty of skills, who, you know, might not want to be a founder but can lend their expertise to something.
Yeah, 100%. So we just started a program called Venture Mentor Service, and it's based on an MIT model of mentoring where the venture actually gets up to 4 people on their in their meetings with them.
Yeah.
So they're either domain experts in terms of a particular tech sector or technology, or they're a business expert. It might be HR, it might be accounting and finance. And depending on what your needs are as a founder at that particular stage you're at in the building of the company, your team can be curated with the skill sets that you require to help you overcome those barriers that you've got. So your team kind of changes as long as you're with the program.
That's great.
Yeah, so we've just launched a pilot of that last month, and after that pilot's over in March next year, in 2020, God, I can't believe we're saying 2020 already, then we'll scale out the program, and anyone who's participated in I2N programs or is an alumni or a student of the university can participate in Venture Mentor Service or VMS.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And so we're calling on, you know, in our pilot pool of mentors, we've got, you know, amazing people from corporates who are volunteering their time to help out these entrepreneurs, which is awesome.
That's great. I do find that about Newcastle. I find people are willing to give their time.
Yeah, 100%.
There's definitely still, we're small enough to still have that community feel, whilst big enough to have that, you know, a decent mass of volume there of people. So
it's growing too, which is exciting. But you're right. You know, I'm from Sydney originally and met an Overcastrian, and we would come up here frequently, you know, to visit family and friends and what have you. And I was always the one like, we should move to Newcastle. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And you know, and we eventually did, and that was like 9 years ago now. Yeah. But I've never had more faith in just what a great city it is. It's not even the matter of potential, like it already kicks so many goals, it's not funny. So the, you know, to be able to do more of that and see that grow even more is super exciting.
Yeah, there's been significant growth over the past 5 years. I think when you first moved up, you worked with Renew Newcastle quite a bit as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
For 4 years, was it?
Yeah, so my background's marketing, and I used to work in publications, down in Sydney Magazine publications, and then the GFC hit and there was no advertising dollars getting spent, and that meant the marketing budgets shrunk, but you had to produce 4 times more sales on half the budget, and you could just see the writing on the wall with digital.
Yeah.
I think the best asset at that time was Vogue.com. You know, that was, and that was really at that point, they hadn't really figured out how to monetize it, and they were looking at, you know, but the engagement was massive because they had a, you know, like a comments feed that was just like had a life of its own. And so you could see the writing was on the wall there, and our kids were about to start school soon, and it was like we either set roots down in Sydney or we set them down in Newcastle, and I was always gunning for Newcastle, so we made the move. And then I was freelancing for quite a while, which was awesome because it really enabled me to build a network of people locally. And one of the connections, first connections I made was Marnie Jackson at Renew Newcastle, who was general manager there at the time. And I had been a fan of Renew since the day, like it started before I moved to Newcastle, but I already knew about it then too. Yeah. And was just thought the model was fabulous. And so I was so excited to be able to work for them and doing their marketing communications, but also developing some of the programs for the creatives that were trying to work out how they monetized their, you know, whatever it was that they were making in the spaces. And so we developed a whole series of programs to help them with business development. And so you see how these empty spaces with creative projects worked really well, and that model was replicated all around the world. Yeah. You could argue we still kind of need it, but the job's not done yet.
Yeah.
You know, there's still lots of empty shops while we transition the CBD. But being able to translate what I did in that space to like deep tech and high tech growth, the principles are really very, very similar. It's just using a different type of skill set, really.
Well, you mentioned there, I think when you came up here, you started freelancing, you built a network, right? And that's obviously led to success in that role and then your role now. From a networking perspective, which I think a lot of people could do better, I think it's invaluable to anyone, doesn't matter where you're at. If you had to give advice to people around networking, you're obviously a strong networker yourself, but hey, somebody is either already here and needs to build their network or is new to the area and wants to build a network, how would you advise people to sort of go about building a network?
Just don't be afraid to join in. There's a lot, you know, I think when I came here, Twitter was still fun. You could have conversations on Twitter with people. Now it's pretty crazy. But when I knew I was moving to Newcastle, I just started following a whole bunch of people on Twitter. So one of them was like Carol Duncan, who used to do the lunchtime show on the ABC 1233, and a few other people, Gordon Whitehead, who now works at the Business Centre.
He was doing coffee mornings for a while there, wasn't he?
Yeah. And so there was a group called Newcastle Coffee Mornings, and Friday morning you'd go at 7:30 and meet at a cafe in town, and it was just this Twitter gang of people who were interested in kind of tech and how this stuff connected you. So I just started going along to those when I first moved up and having conversations with people on Twitter. And then I actually, once I kind of got the lay of the land a little bit and sort of started meeting all these people, I was like there's Newcastle, I love it. I love that they're really bad at telling people how good they are because it's always such a pleasant surprise. You're always constantly finding like these nuggets of gold in the region. And I'm not talking about tech startups necessarily, like research is doing cool stuff, small business operators developing just really great product that's locally made, just innovative thought leaders. It's pretty amazing. And so I was like, people need to know about how good the thought leadership is here. And so at that time, and again, it was just purely kind of like you with the podcast, it was a marketing tool for me, was to how do I get people out there knowing who I am and what my skill set is, which was marketing and event management and program development. And so I got a license for TEDx and did the first TEDx for Newcastle. And that was phenomenal. So it was a full day of talks from a variety of different people, including Marcus Westbury, who started Renew Newcastle, who I wasn't working for at that point, but that's how I ended up getting the job there. One of the talks, which was from Dr. Peter Saul, who works at the John Hunter Hospital as a senior intensivist. He was talking about how important it is to talk about dying, to prepare for people's death. And it actually ended up getting chosen to go onto TED.com. So I think it's like less than 2% of TEDx talks get chosen to go on TED.com. So it's been viewed over a million times now. And it's like, here's this doctor working in Australia's largest regional hospital.
Yeah.
He's doing some really cool stuff to help change culture and perception around talking around this really important issue of death. And what do we do? How do we plan for that? And he's like got this international audience now from this digital tech platform that, you know, 5 years before that never even existed.
Yeah.
So that was really I just knew all of that network effect was so powerful. And that was just going back to my days working in media and PR and fashion and magazines. But just how do you apply that to any opportunity that's around you. Yeah. And it doesn't matter whether or not you're you know, an employee, you're happy being an employee and you're happy at a particular level within a company, you still need to know how to be able to join the dots, because it's going to impress, you know, other people within the company, even if it's not something you're wanting to do to grow your own advantage. You just never know when someone...
The right thing. And also, if you're not moving forward, you're sort of going backward as well, right? Like, even if you are happy at the level you're at, you still got to be improving. Otherwise, people do come up and they'll take those opportunities. You can move backward quite quickly, right? It's about continual progression. And if that's, hey, just meeting more people and gathering new ideas or learning from new people, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think, you know, being able to help people out, you know, you don't know where it's going to lead. You've got no obligation to, like, the only obligation you've got is to make the connection and then let those people take advantage of it or not.
Yeah.
You've got nothing to lose by doing that, right? But there's so much opportunity to be gained. And even if it doesn't work out that time, like, you know, I'm just never deterred from, like, constantly e-introing people or whatever, because you just don't know where it's going to lead. And as you say, Newcastle is small enough to feel like you can be connected, but big enough that you're always still, like, meeting people all the time and learning new things. And
I completely agree. On the flip side of that, what's the biggest challenge for us in Newcastle, do you think, at the moment, whether it be the innovation scene or lots of innovation scene, from what the work that you're doing, what's our biggest challenge in Newcastle, do you think?
In Newcastle specifically, it's probably risk capital. It's a real challenge, particularly if you're working in deep tech startups where you are building out, like, you've got to do a lot of R&D or build out a product that's investment heavy.
Yeah.
Being able to get access to capital to be able to do that is really challenging, particularly in a regional context where we don't have a density of angel investors or VCs. So there's no VC offices in Newcastle. And there's probably only about, you know, 12 in Sydney.
Yeah.
And so the beauty of it is that we are only 2 hours down the road, right? So so we do have that advantage. If you think of other places like Armidale or Wagga or Dubbo.
Yeah, you know, definitely more of a challenge again.
We're really blessed in that way. So we can't complain, absolutely cannot complain. And but the challenge is then when you step outside of Newcastle and you go to, you know, Muswellbrook and Singleton, and it's a completely different story. Even Maitland, it's just a completely different story to what we experience here within Newcastle. But yeah, I think if there's one area that we that would be great to develop more is people's understanding of angel investing as an opportunity for them to be able to generate revenue for themselves.
Yeah, I think because of the success people have had in property in other areas, there's still an inclination to go down the route you know and you've had success with in the past. And, tech investing is, you know, we're in a different spot here in Newcastle and even Australia, compared to definitely in the US or parts of Europe as well, right, where people are more inclined to take that maybe higher risk or invest in tech startups or high growth tech companies as opposed to what people have seen as safe in the past, right?
Yeah, but I guess that's the beauty of angel investing, right, is that you're in a consortia. So you're relying on the knowledge base of all of the angel investors in the consortia to help you make a decision about whether it's a good investment or not. And then it just becomes a matter of experience. So you don't have to know how to code to understand if a tech startup is good or not. It's really understanding what's the opportunity, what's the value creation that company is providing to a market, how big is the market? If you can get that information, it's just a process that you can apply to any investment or potential investment that comes your way. And it's just a learned skill, but it doesn't take a lot to learn it, really. And it's kind of a safeties in numbers game. So it's not like buying a house where you're betting that the property cycle is going to increase in that particular area on that particular street and you're investing your whatever it is, your 200K, your 500K to do that. You can invest 20K 10 times over.
Yeah.
In 10 different startups, and one or two of them hopefully will return the dividends for you.
I don't disagree. It's just I agree with you. I just don't think
it's a mentality. Yeah, for sure. It's a culture shift.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess that goes to your point, like, what is the challenge that we've got? It's culturally, we're just not, and it's not even something that's, you know, just prone to Newcastle. It's in a lot of regional locations and even within CBDs, like major capital cities, it's just the culture of fear of failure in Australia is huge. Yeah. You know, you're really punished for failing in Australia, particularly if you fail in a company and you go bankrupt and you owe that debt.
And on the flip side, there's the tall poppy syndrome as well, that the people that do have success then get, you know, chopped down.
Yeah.
So it's on both ends, right? So,
yeah.
And then back to the other part you even made mention before with people who are, you know, at Muswellbrook, and you've got an opportunity to drive a truck and earn six figures on a, you know, relatively safe and comfortable job, or you could take a risk in business on something that might have a much lesser chance of success, but higher upside. So, I think you're right. It's a mentality thing as well.
Yeah, and I think that we've got a lot of work to do as a country in terms of educating people at a primary school age about enterprise as a skill. It's not it's something that needs to be taught, and you need to be exposed to at a young age, so that you kind of like develop a resistance to being risk averse. Yeah. You know, you're comfortable with risk and failure because you've done a few little projects in primary school where it's the lemonade stand, really, but you're just getting every kid to do the lemonade stand and understand how that works and how you market and how you, you know, deliver a product that adds extra value.
Yeah.
And then doing that through to secondary school and making sure it's compulsory component of, you know, higher education, both within tech. You know, like you're developing all these trades, right? And the chances are many of them will end up starting their own businesses based out of the trade that they're developing. So, and it's trying to think, okay, well, yeah, I'm a plumber and I'm going to start a plumbing company and I might hire a couple of apprentices. But why aren't we thinking I'm going to start a company as a plumber? I'm going to start off with a couple of apprentices, and then in the second year I'm going to get another, you know, a qualified tradesman, and then third year I'm going to get two more, and I'm going to expand it to this market, and I'm going to specialize in this particular area of plumbing or whatever it might be, right? But that mindset, that growth mindset, we don't, you know, develop that at all. So I think that's a huge area, not just for Newcastle, but it's certainly an area that we could have a competitive advantage where if we did have primary schools and high schools and universities working together to be able to develop those skills together as a region.
Well, it sounds like the university, especially through I2N Hub, is providing educational opportunities for people to become educated in and around that space, right? Education is one part of that puzzle, and I think if we can at least nail that part, it's, you know, that's a tick in the right box.
Yeah, definitely.
It doesn't tick all the boxes, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, and so with our very first, the early stage program that we offer, Entrepreneurship 101 or E101, that is, it's just the fundamentals of enterprise skill development, essentially, like what's a value proposition, what is a business model canvas, how do I interview customers to understand where they're thinking and the jobs that they've got to do, the pains they're experiencing doing those jobs, what product or solution do I need to develop to help address those, how big is that market, all that kind of, it's just basic stuff. And you can just watch the videos and not have a particular idea in mind that you apply it to, but when you do have an idea, then you can apply those principles just over and over and over again. And anyone can do that program, right? So you could be in year seven, you got the lemonade stand with a difference. You could do that program and then you've got access to it forever. As long as the program's up online, you've got access to it forever. So, and that was the idea of, you know, delivering a program that was online, that we could get those enterprise skills principles in the hands of as many people as possible.
Yeah.
So that we could develop that kind of pipeline.
The pipeline's, that's a big part of it, right? It's just about continuing to sort of churn that out and have more and more people come through that. And as you said, and then on the flip side of that, have the alumni feedback in, and it becomes
a nice this virtuous cycle. Yeah.
That'd be perfect. And especially when we're having more successes, I think that's a part, especially in the sort of innovation space or the startup or scale-up space now, where you're having some success stories come out of Newcastle. I think people feed off the back of that. Hey, it can be done here. Hey, there are some, you know, companies closing really significant rounds now and having successes, which drives more successes. And then some of those people become mentors for other people. I know Justin's done really well with Campify, and he's starting to feed back as a mentor to other people coming through. And you sort of start to see that, and yeah, you, it continues to build that, build the ecosystem, right?
Yeah, there's the Boulder effect is exactly what you've described, which is based in Boulder, Colorado. Yeah. So, you know, a rural area, not Silicon Valley, not Boston, but has developed, like is punching above its weight significantly. And it is that culture of that entrepreneurship recycling, and that's what we're trying to develop here as well. And luckily, Novocastrians are just really awesome people that like to have a chat and like to be able to help out anyway. I think that's just the Aussie culture, right?
Yeah.
And so it's easy for us to do.
Completely agree. Obviously, we do tackle this part in our podcast most times when it comes to the education, where do you get to?
Mm-hmm.
You went about it a little bit differently as well, because you've got an MBA without the bachelor's degree, right?
Yeah,
so you've
that's
done
right.
Career and then gone got the MBA.
Mm.
How has that contributed? Well, let's start with what was your experience like doing an MBA?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Phenomenal. So I came from a family where nobody went to university. Yep. It was leave school, get a job.
Yep.
On the job experience is the best kind of experience. Both my parents were financial administrators at schools and self-taught to get themselves into those positions. So they were kind of like, we did pretty well without uni, so I guess you could, like, they were supportive if you wanted to go to university, but it wasn't like they were buying me the UAT guide and gently nudging me to open days or anything like that. There was just no expectation at all. And when I was at school, I wanted to get into hospitality. I love helping people. And so I wanted to get into hospitality and I wanted to be a concierge at a hotel. So I went and did food and beverage management at TAFE. Dropped out of that because I got a job offer to be in a chef's apprenticeship because I was doing dishwashing at a restaurant at night. At night, while I was doing the food and beverage course at TAFE, did the chef's apprenticeship for a while, which I loved, but soon realized I was never going to have a social life, and I was working double shifts and night shifts and things like that. And so I actually got really bad dermatitis from my hands being wet all the time and exposed. And so I went and saw a nutritionist, and it just completely changed my, I got rid of the dermatitis. So that really interested, I got really interested in nutrition, studied a diploma in nutrition, then got completely diverted and got a job while I was studying nutrition in fashion, got really interested in public relations, worked on Donna Hay magazine, in food, thinking one day maybe I'll be the nutrition, like recipe writer, which she was like, no, that's not our bag. Our bag is, you know, cakes and, you know, beautiful, bad, dull, indulgent, but great looking food. Now, funnily enough, she has her own magazines purely for, I think I was just ahead of the time for health and wellness. Yeah. So I just never considered undergraduate study ever. Even after I finished the diploma, there was an option to go on to do more study in nutrition. But when I started working at the University of Newcastle about 5 years ago, obviously, I mean, in that kind of an environment, you're hearing really inspirational stories from people who have just found their niche and they're killing it. They're making real world impact with, you know, the area that they've decided to focus on. And I was always very envious of people that were able to know exactly what they wanted to do. Like, who are these people? Like in high school, and they know they want to be a doctor and they get straight in there. And, you know, like I was never one of those people. I could really never figure out what I was going to do. And so, you know, I luckily had some really amazing colleagues who really nudged me in the direction of just do a grad cert first. I thought I was going to have to do a bachelor's first, a bachelor of business or marketing. And then I found out that all my work experience that I'd done accumulated over the previous 15 years was enough to get me into postgrad. So I did a grad cert in marketing first, and the marketing, actually the subjects, I was like, I felt like I knew it already, so I was like, oh, maybe I should do something a little bit different. So rather than do a master's of marketing, I'll do the MBA instead, so I can learn some new aspects of business management that I'm probably not as au fait with. And so I'm glad I did that, because it was a really well-rounded, you know, really good electives you could choose from.
Nice.
It was not a slog. I loved it, but juggling that with a full-time job and family commitments is pretty challenging. So my husband is amazing, and now I don't know what to do with all my spare time because I'm finished.
I've heard that about MBA, right? It's a pretty big commitment if you are, you know, if you've got a family and you've got a full-time job and commitments. But other than on the flip side, I've heard many people like yourself who've said extremely positive experience, really happy I did it. Yeah, I don't hear too many people at the end of having done it be I'm disappointed I did that by any means.
It's yeah, no.
It's positive. Positive outlook. A lot of acknowledgement of the hard work. But yeah, overall positive.
And it's not so much about the what you learn in the it's that people that you meet. Yeah. And because Newcastle is like the University of Newcastle is the one uni in town. We're a real anchor institute within the region. It's where a lot of working professionals go to get their higher ed. So you're working with people who you're probably going to, like I've had meetings now as a result of my interactions with them in the MBA on a professional level to build partnerships that way.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
So it's been really valuable.
I agree. That's nice. And education's a part to where you get to then. As you said, I think you've jumped around. Careers is not too dissimilar to myself and other people. It's just you don't know where that is going to, where you'll end up, right? And
yeah, totally.
It's just those different life experiences bring you to where you are today.
There isn't one way to do it, right?
No, definitely not. Outside of that, you've also done some courses through General Assembly as well in the past.
Yeah, that was a long time. Well, it feels like a long time ago, but it actually wasn't that long ago. I think it was business. I can't even remember what it was. Digital growth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was your experience doing it through an institute like that?
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I was living in Sydney at the time, so it was really convenient for me to get to General Assembly at that time. And it just filled some gaps. It was a short course and it just filled some gaps in some knowledge I was missing around social media marketing.
Yeah.
So at that time it was when I did that, it was pretty there was a lot to figure out. You know, Facebook was changing, like was developing that business model and changing the way it did it really rapidly. And that course definitely provided filled a lot of those gaps where I was just like, I think this is how it works, or I think this is what I should be doing. And I was like, okay, I'm on the right track.
I think those sort of providers, fill a nice little niche there for that. Just a little short course, nail a skill and then move on.
Definitely.
And I think that's a really good opportunity for them to still be a part of that, greater educational
system. Oh, absolutely. And, technology is changing things so rapidly that it's those kinds of little, micro-credentialed programs that you can do. And then, like, the online offering now is just phenomenal.
Completely agree. Completely agree. Cool. We'll wrap up with a little bit about you. And obviously you live in a really busy job. There's lots of parts to it. How do you manage your day from a productivity perspective? Any tools you use, any theories, any way of doing things to manage your day, manage your workload?
So I'm a big, big fan of, I've tried everyone. Like I'm what do they call it? A master of none. I'm just try everything. So I've tried online. We actually use Trello in the office for project management stuff. Like particular events and projects that we're working on, but I've tried them all, Asana, like every single one of them. And the only thing I find works really well is writing things down.
Yeah.
So I'm a big fan of bullet journaling.
Yeah.
Massive advocate for that. And in fact, I've really fallen off the wagon with bullet journaling over the last month or so, and I'm really feeling it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't take much to get back into it and do it right. But man, it makes such a difference to my day. I just find writing and ticking, just a very rewarding and helpful way.
And I think everyone remembers things differently as well, right? And a lot of people, I think you're right, a lot of people, that act of writing things down makes a difference.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. From an educational perspective, any books you'd recommend to people?
Well, talking about interesting pathways to getting to where you are, I just finished reading a book called Educated by Tara Westhoff.
Yeah.
She's got a really unique upbringing, a story to tell in her upbringing, but it talks about the power of education and what impact it can have on your worldview and the relationships you build as a result of it, particularly with your family.
Yeah.
It was like I've never sat down and read a book an autobiography like that in 2 days. Like I just could not put it down. It was the most fascinating story, so I highly recommend that.
We'll link that up in the podcast.
Yeah, and then what else am I? Oh, okay. So I was just at a conference in it's called the Global Consortium of Entrepreneurship Centers Conference. It happens every year somewhere in the world, and this year it was in Europe. And the keynote speaker was Hans Rosling's son. I should know his first name, but I can't think of what it is.
That's all right.
He's a big data visualization specialist, so he's done a couple of TED Talks as well. And he started a company called Gapminder, which is about how do you use information to present real world facts. So what they have done is developed this website called gapminder.org, and you go on it and it provides you with, I think, 12 questions that you have to answer. So for an example, one is scientists agree that temperatures on Earth will either rise, decline, or stay the same over in the future. So you pick which one, right? So it's questions around perceptions around society and how we're performing. And it gives you your answers at the end, how wrong or right you are. And what's really interesting in the research that they've done around people's responses, particularly if you get people as a cohort to respond, so they've had like Nobel laureates as one group respond to these questions. No one's gotten all 12 right. And whether you break it up by country or by age or by job, it really gives you an idea of where people are getting their information from and how wrong they are about their perceptions around what's actually happening in the world.
Yep.
And I would highly recommend people going and doing this and keep doing it until you get all 12 right, because you do get a little certificate at the end.
Yeah, wow.
But what it does is it sets your worldview correctly.
Yeah.
You know, so whatever perceptions you have about there being a developing countries and developed countries, that paradigm doesn't exist anymore. There's four stages, and the majority of people in the world are in the two middle ones.
Yeah, wow.
So it's very rare that people are in extreme poverty, and very rare that you're in extreme wealth. So the huge market opportunities that are available in the middle class in what we used to call developing countries is huge now. So China and India is like massive market potential for technology applications in those markets, because they've got money to spend. So I'd highly recommend going on to GetMinder.org.
I think I'm going to do that this afternoon. That sounds really good.
Like, so they're not like books, but they're good online
useful tools. So we'll link that up. And obviously that way people can, you know, follow those people as well.
Yeah,
nice. Last question. Anything that you've learned that you would sort of, if you had your opportunity again, teach a younger version of yourself, hey, don't make that mistake, or you should do this, or...
That's a really interesting question. Probably just back yourself more. I don't know if it's a female thing. I don't know if it's just my personality, but often don't feel like I should be at the table. Yep. Sometimes don't feel qualified. Maybe that comes from not having an undergraduate degree. I don't know. But I think if I was probably able to back myself a little bit more and feel more comfortable being at the table and feeling like I belonged there, then I think, you know, that you see it when people are confident and they, you know, they express themselves confidently. More often than not, they don't know what the hell they're talking about, right? There was a great quote recently from Michelle Obama, where, you know, someone had asked her, what was it like being in the room with all of these, you know, really smart people from all around the world? And she's like, well, most of the time they didn't know what was really going on. Yeah. And if they did the Gapminder quiz, they really didn't know what was going on, which was super scary because they're the policymakers, right, making these decisions. Most people don't know what's actually really going on. They think they have an idea and they might be right about some of it, but we don't know everything. And so the best thing to do is talk to as many people as you can, ask as many questions as you can, which I haven't done in this interview. We had a good chat beforehand, I suppose. Find out about people's stories and what they have to offer. And you deserve to be there as much as everybody else does.
Okay. There's a lot of power in listening, which I definitely wouldn't have... said when I was a younger version of myself and I thought I knew everything.
Right, me too.
The older you get, you're like, oh, there's a lot I don't know. There's a lot of power in listening.
It's like it's the opposite, right?
Yeah.
The older you get, the more you realise you absolutely have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Thank you very much for coming in today. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been awesome.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of Newey Tech People, and thank you again for your continued support. To check out this episode's show notes and the show notes and episodes that we've recorded in the past, please visit www.neweytechpeople.com.au. We've got some exciting changes and new features being uploaded there in the very near future. Thanks again for your support.